Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. This is going to be in every way a historic episode. Firstly, because it's the first episode that we've done at a podcast festival. So it's absolutely fantastic to be here. We've been going for less than a year, and so to actually be here and to see you guys, well, I can just about see you guys out there, is really fantastic. So thanks so much for coming. Also, this is going to be a historic episode because, as you can probably tell, even though they have a kind of similar degree of follicle challenge, this is not Dominic. This is Professor Ali Ansari of the University of St. Andrews, Professor of Iranian Studies. And the reason that Ali is here rather than Dominic is because Dominic has only gone and caught COVID. He's over the worst. I think he was quite ill, so I mustn't be horrid about it and accuse him of malingering. I think he really was ill. And he's on his last day of quarantine. So absolutely terrible timing. But, you know, every cloud has a silver lining. And the silver lining in this case is Ali. And those of you who are regular listeners to the podcast may well remember the episode we did on Persia, in which Ali was set, you were set the challenge of basically proving that everything came from Persia.
I think I did rather well.
So what was it? It was religion,
empire,
high heels,
time, high heels,
suits,
spaghetti, which sort of slightly went off the edge. Actually, I have to say, after a while, I got some abuse for that. I have to say.
And the British Civil Service.
The British Civil Service, I thought it was pretty,
Yeah, so if you haven't listened to that, Ali conclusively demonstrating that everything is basically Persian, please do. But the third reason that this is a historic podcast is, of course, because it's about history. And today's episode, we are going to look at the top 10 mistresses in history. And in a way, this is a companion piece to an earlier episode we did, the top 10 eunuchs in history. It's been a kind of running theme, genital mutilation, but we're trying to kind of expand on that. And actually, they're similar because what both of them do, firstly, they kind of, you know, inherently salacious, so it does enable us to talk about, you know, fair degree of filth, I suppose. But it's not just about the filth, truly, ladies and gentlemen, because actually the subject of mistresses, I mean, Ali, it's about those who are powerless, rather as with eunuchs, it's about those who are powerless having a chance actually to exert influence.
That's right. Basically, the ability to exert political influence at quite an intimate level, I suppose, is the way to look at it. But they do exert the influence. They do it. Although, as we'll see as we go down the list, I mean, some exert less than others. But
yes. So the format we're going to do is we've drawn up 10,
right.
And Dominic has also had his feedback. So he's contributed to this list.
He's here
so the
in
three
spirit.
Of us.
He is
yes.
definitely here in spirit, and I will be calling for a friend if I need to.
So the three of us have come up with this. Basically, this top
right.
10, and we'll be going from number 10 up, all the way up to number 1, the person we think is the yeah. most influential mistress in history. And basically, the parameters are you have to have come from nowhere and exerted a kind of incredible influence on the course of history or whatever. So that's basically are the specifications. Mm-hmm. Ali, do you want to kick off? Because you'll see up there, We've got our first one at number 10.
Yes, we have the Nightingale.
The Nightingale, yes. Who I had never heard of.
But yes.
Is she in any way Persian?
Well, the truth is, yes. Is she influential? Probably not. But it was partly as your means of getting me on this podcast that I insisted that we at least have one person on there that came from Persia. And this is, obviously, when we're looking at the topic of mistresses, it's a bit difficult. As much as I scoured through Persian history and general Islamic history to find that, you'll find that the patriarchy is not only entrenched, but it's probably institutionalized. So what you have is a situation where if you can have many wives and many concubines, mistresses are somewhat surplus to requirements. So it's a bit, it was quite difficult to locate. So the Nightingale was basically a concubine rather than a mistress of an early 19th century Persian king. But she's notable for the influence she exerted on him. And you'll acknowledge, of course, and I'll have to acknowledge that the influence was pretty slight because this king had, I think about 1,000 concubines. So, but the interesting thing is it was noticed that this particular dancing girl from Shiraz, as it turns out, had obviously captured the heart of this king, the painting of whom you saw
yesterday. What's his name?
His name is, and I shall have to sort of say it, but no tittering please in the audience, is Fat Ali Shah. Now, not that describes his look, as Tom will verify, having seen the painting. He was rather, and he had very sporting high heels, I have to say.
He had sporting high heels, and he had the most enormous beard, didn't he?
The enormous beard was the sign of virility.
So Ali and I went yesterday to the exhibition on Epic Iran at the Victoria and Albert Museum.
That's right.
If you haven't seen it, it's really wonderful. And this guy, Fat Ali Shah...
He's not particularly fat.
But he does have the most enormous beard. And I'm guessing that a large beard is a sign of virility. That you can cope with 1,000 concubines.
He had a... I mean, interestingly, that your previous podcast was on eunuchs, because his uncle was a eunuch. Sadly, yes, castrated at the tender age of 6 in order to prevent him actually becoming king. But that didn't stop him. Because he couldn't obviously have any children, his nephew decided to really go for it. And basically created an entire tribe on his own. He's quite a character, this chap. But what's interesting about the nightingale, whose name in Persian actually is Tuti, which, as Tom and I were discussing earlier, actually means parrot, which is not quite as attractive a name. But the term in Persian, I suppose, is a little bit more... it was meant to be a little bit more dismissive.
I prefer
nightingale, because I think nightingale sounds nicer.
So what influence did she exert? How did this...
The only influence really that I could find that she exerted is, one is that she came to the notice of British observers at the time, who said that she clearly had captured the heart of the king, which, let's face it, if you have 1,000 concubines and it's the one that captured the heart, that's not bad. And that she died very young, tragically, and that the king was very moved by this and was seen to visit her grave regularly and with melancholia. And actually what they said was that this young girl basically humanised this king. I mean, so she had a modest influence. I have to say, if I wasn't here, I don't think she'd get into the top 10.
I thought the least she would have encouraged him to invade Persia, invade
India,
she or
was
something.
No, he was far too busy in the harem. I mean, 1,000 concubines. I mean, is there time for anything else?
Okay, yes.
So that, I'm afraid...
So she didn't do anything. She died young and she was called the parrot.
But she was Persian.
But
she was noticed. She was noticed by the British, and she was Persian. And I suppose she does reflect, and it allows us to talk a little bit about this, I suppose, is the fact that, yes, in these societies where you had, what can we say, you know, you can have 4 wives and as many concubines as you can afford. I mean, mistresses don't really come into it.
Okay, so you can see, ladies and gentlemen, why the nightingale or the parrot was at number 10.
That's right.
So that's her. So number 9, you said that the parrot had, or nightingale, had
let's go for nightingale, I think.
Had
I
mean, no influence on history. Our next one is someone who had an absolutely outsized influence on history.
God,
and you may well be surprised to discover she's only at 9.
Yeah.
Cleopatra... in at number 9, of course, is one of the great names, not just in ancient history, but in global history, absolute kind of historical celebrity. The mistress of the 2 most powerful men in the world, first Julius Caesar and then Mark Antony. And you may be wondering, well, why is she so low? Well, the answer is that by our rubric, you have to come from nowhere and achieve great things. Cleopatra is the Queen of Egypt. She, of course, is not as powerful as the Roman warlords who control the day, because middle of the first century BC, Rome is the superpower and Egypt is pretty much the only independent kingdom left after several centuries of Roman conquests across the Mediterranean. But Cleopatra is a player. She is bringing things that both Caesar and Antony want. And I think it's absolutely telling that, you know, the reputation of Cleopatra, among the Romans, and then kind of more recent works of pornography, for instance, have been obsessed by her, is that she had a voracious sexual appetite. And this explains her relentless appetite. In fact, as far as we know, she only ever slept with 2 men. And these 2 men both happened to be incredibly powerful. And I think that tells you what she was about. She slept with first Julius Caesar and then with Mark Antony because she needed Roman power. First of all, with Caesar to establish her on the Egyptian throne. So she was she came from a long line of Macedonian kings and queens who had adopted the native Egyptian tradition of brother and sister marrying each other. And Cleopatra was initially married to her younger brother, Ptolemy the 13th, but she didn't want him around, kind of pesky younger brother. So she gets embroiled in a civil war in Alexandria. Caesar turns up. Cleopatra, according to the story, has herself delivered to Caesar, rolled up in a carpet.
That's right.
And I think that Cleopatra has kind of, if that's true, has judged Caesar's character.
But I mean, the interesting thing about her, I suppose, is where the balance of power is, really, because they, yeah. Certainly with Mark Antony, I think she's very much, got the whip hand, hasn't she?
Well, she gets it. I mean, certainly yeah. With Caesar, it's evident. She's a kind of, the classic paradigm of the mistress, someone yeah. who is very kind of dependent on Caesar. But then once Caesar's established her securely on the throne, she becomes a player in her own
something
right.
Something of the sort of the outsider when she yes. when the Romans don't really take to her, do they?
Well, she goes to Rome
yeah.
Just before the Ides of March and causes a great scandal. She snubs Cicero, who's a kind of
never
very offended by this.
Yeah, never snub an academic.
Never snub the academic.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And then the Ides of March happens yeah. and Cleopatra's got herself pregnant as well. With
Caesar. Was she there over the Ides of March?
Yes, she's there at the Ides of March, and she's her young son, Caesarion. Giving a clue as to who the father
is.
So her plan, basically to establish a kind of dynastic union with the most powerful man in Rome, is foiled by Caesar's assassination. And the Roman world gets divided between Mark Antony, mm-hmm. Caesar's best lieutenant, and the future Augustus, Octavian, who is his adopted son. The world gets split. Mark Antony takes the eastern half of the Roman Empire and summons Cleopatra in a very imperious way to Tarsus, where he's made his base. And Cleopatra, who had wowed Caesar by being rolled up in the carpet, wows Antony, who's a much more vulgar man, by turning up with the most incredible bling. So massive kind of barge. This is the thing that Shakespeare makes kind of wonderful kind of purple
passage. And
presumably
Mark Antony was quite taken by the fact that he would be going with Caesar's mistress.
That's absolutely part of it. Yes,
yes.
But essentially, Cleopatra
is
wowing him with her, her gold, her splendor, her pizzazz, and
could you say she emasculates him?
No, because Antony and Cleopatra are definitely a pair, a unit.
But like politically emasculates him.
Well, that's what subsequently happens because Antony has an affair with Cleopatra, then goes back. Basically signs a peace treaty with Octavian by the terms of which he will marry Octavian's sister Octavia, who is a kind of upright Roman matron, very much not Cleopatra. Antony stays with her for a while, but then basically bins her and shacks up with Cleopatra. And the propaganda in Rome coming from the future Augustus, which then gets picked up by Roman historians and in due course by Shakespeare and Cecil B. DeMille and Elizabeth Taylor and so on, is that this is all for love.
Mm.
But the probability is that it's a kind of dynastic throw. Antony is looking essentially to get rid of his pesky partner in the rule of the Roman world. Mm. He needs Cleopatra for that. But it all goes wrong. Antony and Cleopatra get defeated at Actium. And by that point, basically, Cleopatra's the powerful one because Cleopatra's the queen of Egypt, but Antony's lost everything.
Nothing. Yeah.
So Antony dies, and the story is that Cleopatra then makes a pitch at Octavian.
Oh, that wouldn't have gone down well, I don't think.
Well, Octavian doesn't need her, though. So.
I must admit, I thought the sort of the sibling marrying stuff was all Zoroastrian, but you're saying the Egyptians are up to it as well, which is quite interesting.
And they got their first.
I'm going to try and get something Persian in
my head. The Egyptians got their first.
Did they?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Yeah. It's terrible. That's the finest achievement of the Persian. But anyway,
And then Cleopatra, of course, famously commits suicide rather than walk in Caesar's triumph.
Yeah, that's right.
With the asp smuggled in the basket of figs. And by that point, you could almost say that the roles have reversed, and it's Cleopatra is the powerful one, and Antony is the suitor.
Yeah.
And so that then opens up a question which is focused by our next one,
which is interesting, isn't
which
it?
Is the question: can there be a male mistress?
That's right.
So, Ali, do you want to?
Well, this takes me back to my medieval.
So, who is number eight?
So, Piers Gaveston. who was the, shall we call it, you know, the intimate friend of Edward II. And as I understand, was actually introduced into the household by his father, Edward Longshanks, which is probably not the wisest thing to have done, because he then discovered that the relationship between his son and Piers Gaveston was getting a little bit too close. Now, of course, we don't know, you know, posthumously they've talked about how intimate that relationship was, but clearly he had a degree of influence which the nobility in England after Edward became king weren't particularly keen on. So there's a sort of an interesting dynamic there about whether we can categorise Piers Gaveston as a sort of a mistress type.
Well, he's a favourite, isn't he?
He's a favourite.
So men who come from nowhere, or you know, not even from nowhere. I mean, you know, Gaveston
came
is
from Gascony.
Yeah, he's from Gascony. Nowhere. I mean, he's kind of well born. But the idea of the favourite who is over promoted is a very distinctive category. But I think that what makes Gaveston kind of interesting is that, as you say, there is absolutely these kind of, there do seem to have been these rumours that there were kind of sexual dimension to it. And that gets picked up by Christopher Marlowe, who writes a play about it. And it's fed into, I think, the Piers Gaveston Club at Oxford is the Bullingdon Club.
Yes.
For kind of people who wear opera cloaks.
Very debauched. Yeah, no, I
didn't. So anyway,
but it does bring in this. I mean, it is an interesting sort of relationship. I mean, whether, you know, we were talking about, you know, later monarchs such as Catherine the Great, who had a string of sort of male lovers, who played a very sort of influential role in her. I mean, actually helped her kill her husband, actually, which was.
But I guess they'd be favourites. I mean, they would count as favourites.
Yeah, but they were sort of. Quite, and I think Gaveston is a sort of a famous one of these in that sense.
Because I think that, I mean, the reason that Gaveston causes so much trouble, it seems from the sources isn't really because of the sexual dimension, if that indeed that existed. It is because he's clearly a massive lad. He's really good at tournaments, and he's on campaign with Edward I in Scotland, and he bunks off to go to a tournament, which is, you know, not the kind of behaviour.
The interesting thing is, if Edward I has introduced him, he must have thought highly of him. I mean, that's the thing.
But I think he regrets it.
He does regret it.
And then the moment Edward dies, Edward II is lavishing gifts on him. He makes him the Earl of Cornwall. And Gaveston enters the tournament again and kind of humiliates the established aristocracy. So I think it's that really...
He's a bit of a show-off, really.
He's a kind of peacock.
He's driven up with his Lamborghini and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
And the traditional aristocracy aren't very keen on this sort of thing.
And so the aristocracy are kind of endlessly trying to get rid of him.
Yeah.
And Edward is kind of forced to send him into exile, and then Gaveston comes back, and then the cycle, you know, goes over and over and over. And then finally in 1312, Gaveston gets cornered and executed.
And his end is not pretty, is it? I don't think. I mean, if I remember...
No, he just his head gets chopped off. It's Edward II whose end is not
but
pretty.
But wasn't Piers Gaveston hung, drawn and quartered?
No, I think he just got executed.
Just head chopped off. It's all right. But Edward II had it rather, yeah.
Well, everybody involved in this story,
terrible
things are told of them. So all the stuff about Gaveston, you know, the rumours, we don't know whether they're true or not. Edward II, notoriously, he ends up getting deposed... by his wife, Isabella, the she-wolf of France, and her lover, and he gets put in Berkeley Castle, and terrible screams are heard. And the story is, of course, that he is killed by having a red-hot poker shoved up his anus, perhaps to disguise what had happened, and perhaps as a kind of brutal joke
perhaps
about his relationship.
Also, was it also because you mustn't shed royal blood?
Yeah, that as well.
That's a very sort of like, that's a rather, you know, Middle Eastern idea, but no matter.
Possibly Persian?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, interestingly, I was reading, as I told you, I was reading one of the earliest histories of Britain, written actually by a Persian traveller, who accounts for this, actually describes the death of Edward II in some detail. He finds it quite interesting. Yes,
so what did he say?
Well, he just says he had something stuck up an orifice.
And yeah, does he not elaborate?
He just says, you know, that was just the way it was. I think these are sort of routine means of execution.
These barbarian kings.
Actually, interestingly, he also adds, which I'll throw in here, that, you know, the only reason Henry VIII had so many problems with his wives is he couldn't have more than one at the same time. I mean, if he could, like, you know, good Persian kings, it'd be no problem.
But his wife, Isabella, it was said of her that at the age of 70, She took an alchemical elixir that enabled her to have sex with 40 young men at a time.
What is the she-wolf?
Yes.
We told you it was going to get selection.
So shocking, shocking detail. But all I'm sure not true.
Goodness knows what.
So we only mention it to discount it, which is very much having your cake.
That would be quite 40. Having
your cake and eating it.
Yeah, having your cake. Yeah, absolutely.
So. So do we think, I mean, Piers Gaveston's kind of a mistress, isn't he?
He is. I think we've got to be, you know, we've got to look at this, you know, with a level playing field, really. And I mean, I think he definitely, you know, he uses his intimacy to gain influence.
But it does, I mean, it does highlight the way in which, overwhelmingly, we are talking about societies in which it's the men who have power.
Yeah.
And in a sense, therefore, for men to have, to obtain power through sexual relations is inherently seen as aberrant.
Yes. No. That's absolutely. Yeah, that's true. Actually. Yeah.
Unless you're in a society where you have eunuchs.
Yeah.
Which takes us back to the previous episode. Right. So I think that Piers Gaveston. I mean, he's kind of interesting choice, and a good choice. But I think doesn't deserve to feature any higher than number 8. So shall we move on to number 7?
Number 7.
Okay. So number 7. There was a gentleman. I was coming on the tube here, and he recognised me and said that he was coming here. So I don't know if you're here, gentleman. Yes, there your hand goes up. Lovely to see you. I'm so glad you made it.
He wasn't making it up. Yeah, no.
And I was. I never make anything up.
I was
busy reading a book, kind of swatting up, ready for this. And the book was a biography of Nelson, which will give you a clue as to the woman who comes in at number 7.
Well, I have to say, she's a particular favourite of mine, but you can.
Emma Hamilton, Lady Hamilton, who famously had an affair with, well, more than an affair, a great kind of lifelong, a great passion with Admiral Nelson.
Yeah.
And I think that we can say of Emma Hamilton that she absolutely fits the paradigm of the woman who comes from nowhere and uses her sex appeal, uses her charm, uses her intelligence to rise massively above the station into which she was born. And of course, in 1765, when she was born, England is an incredibly stratified society. And Emma is born in Cheshire, quite humble background, but she heads to London, as so many ambitious people, both male and female, did. And London, of course, is a terribly dangerous, threatening place for young people with high ambitions. So Emma was always kind of treading a tightrope of potential ruin. And for women particularly, you know, those who are going to use their sex appeal, the risk is always that you kind of end up pregnant, ruined, and just thrown on the dung heap. So Emma is taking huge, huge risks in going to London. She enters the kind of the theatrical world again, as so many successful mistresses do.
Like the Nightingale.
Yeah. So she works as an actress. She's employed as a maid to actresses.
Yeah,
so she kind of picks up on that, and she becomes a dancer. And her ability to, I mean, they have dancers in Persia.
That's right. She was very
so almost
famous for her beauty, of course. The thing with Emma Hamilton is just for me the most is the tragedy of it all. Actually, I mean, to be honest, I mean, she's basically passed on from one successful man to another.
The first one. So her achievement is to bag a man, a powerful posh man, and this man is Charles Greville, who seems to be rather boring.
Much older.
Is very rich.
Yeah, fair enough.
So Charles Greville, it's a kind of My Fair Lady scenario. So he puts her up in a house in Paddington, and Emma is very, very, she shows herself to be very proficient at languages. So she learns Italian and French very quickly. She becomes great friends with the Queen.
Of Naples.
Yeah, the Queen of Naples. And she has this great thing. It's always my favourite thing about her that she, and this is again where the dancing comes in.
Yeah.
They're called Emma Hamilton's attitudes.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes, I read about
and
it.
And she kind of... She uses her control of dance and mime to simulate scenes from classical antiquity.
So
William Hamilton's pots, you know, there'll be nymphs or something on the pots. And she will pose. And you know, before YouTube, this is the kind of hottest ticket in Naples.
Yeah.
So everyone gathers round to watch her do her attitudes. And it's all, you know, it's all great fun.
Very Enlightenment stuff, isn't it, really?
Yes, yeah, yes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Nelson turns up.
Oh, yes.
And he kind of turns up in the early 1790s, and you know, the eyes meet across crowded rooms.
Mm, mm.
But then the thing that really kind of lights the taper is that Nelson turns up after the Battle of the Nile, where he has destroyed the French fleet. Napoleon's gone to Egypt, try and conquer Egypt, which he does, but gets stranded because Nelson has sailed into the mouth of the Nile, and with great daring has destroyed the French fleet. And as a result, is absolutely the kind of, you know, the toast of the anti-French Europe, and particularly of Britain, goes back to Naples, is informed that he's become Lord Nelson, and he needs a rest. He needs to recharge his batteries. And Emma recharges his batteries for him.
You put it so well. I mean, you put it... Well, I have to say, yes, William Hamilton is quite... how should we say? I mean,
he's quite mellow about it.
Yeah, he is. He doesn't take it too badly, does he? I mean, he's
a mellow guy.
Yeah, yeah. And there's definitely something there where it's definitely a passionate love affair, isn't it? Between
yes. Yeah. So they both... Yes, and Nelson, of course, and the reason that Emma is a mistress... is that Nelson is married.
He's married, yeah. Not
to Fanny,
yeah, he's not,
who is back in kind of wet, dank,
yeah,
dreary Norfolk,
not great,
with apologies to anyone from Norfolk. But it can't measure up to the sheer pizzazz and excitement of the court.
Emma Hamilton, yeah, absolutely.
And Emma with her attitudes,
yeah,
and her general sense of fun. And Nelson just gets completely besotted. And there's, in due course, there's a kind of a revolution which Nelson helps to, well, it does more than help, I mean, basically puts down. And this becomes a cause of considerable controversy back in England. You know, has he gone too far? Has he been too brutal with it? But Nelson helps to put that down, and then they all go back home to England because William Hamilton has been recalled. And so they go back across Europe via Vienna, where Haydn in Vienna, it gets obsessed by Emma, big fan. Go back to England, and Nelson, of course, is the hero that England needs at this difficult time in the war against Napoleon. He's tremendously charismatic. He's the great hero who saved Britain. He has colour. He is in every way the kind of the pin-up, and.
And then he dies.
He brings this baggage of celebrity because it's kind of absolute tabloid fodder because his wife is distraught, doesn't want to give him up without a fight. Nelson's obsessed with Emma. Emma is still with William Hamilton. The whole thing is absolute kind of, you know, it's brilliant. Everybody's obsessed by it
but writing it up.
And everywhere they go, they're being followed.
But
so it's exactly like the tabloids.
But I was surprised that this early stage, because, you know, I always thought, you know, this sort of more prudish attitudes come out, you know, later on with the Victorian era, that the idea of someone having a mistress would have been, I suppose George III never had mistresses, did he? So he probably didn't set the tone wasn't right.
Well,
was
it is a little bit more Puritan
than we might have thought.
Well, no, I mean, it doesn't lose Nelson his popularity. In a way,
but
it kind of enhances
it.
She gets it
quite tough.
So
it's not exactly a...
So Nelson ends up, you know, he leaves his wife. Hamilton dies. Nelson and Emma shack up together in a house in Merton, next to the River Wandle.
Right.
So I'm very keen on walking London's rivers, and you walk the River Wandle, and suddenly every pub, every street is named after Nelson, and you know that you've reached the site of the long vanished house that he and Emma Hamilton
not
lived
after
in.
Emma.
Yeah. So of course, and they have a daughter, Horatia.
Yeah.
So, which is giving
a massive clue as to who the father is.
I mean, they couldn't, you know.
Caesarian,
and also,
Horatia
looks exactly like Nelson.
Oh, dear.
I mean, obviously, she has an arm and
she
hasn't lost an eye.
Yeah,
but apart from that, she looks very like him. and then, of course, Nelson sails off, dies at Trafalgar.
And
as he's dying, he thinks of Emma, and he says, you know, please look after Emma, make sure that Emma is cared for. And he misses Emma so much that it is said, that prompts him to ask Hardy to give him a kiss. Doesn't have Emma there, so Hardy will do, and then he dies.
So you think he actually did say to Hardy? I thought it was Kismet. I thought it was about destiny or something.
Oh, the Persian thing again.
Well, yeah, I thought it was, yeah. No, but the bad news is, of course, is that once Nelson dies, I think it's his brother, isn't it, who sort of inherits everything.
Yes.
And his brother is a vicar, is that right?
Yes.
And rather, how should we say, you know, not... He doesn't approve, let's put it that way.
Yes.
And then, of course, you know, one of the things that I found it's quite tragic, is that you have this extraordinary funeral, obviously, state funeral for Nelson, held in St. Paul's and everything, all sort of glorious, technical and everything. And the one person who isn't invited is Emma.
Yeah.
And she's left outside, basically.
Yeah.
And from then on, she's effectively ostracised. I mean, she's...
And loses her money.
Yeah. I mean, it is tragic.
Has to sell the house at Merton.
Sell the house, yeah.
Goes to debtor's prison. Gets freed by some of Nelson's friends, but she kind of, you know, dies, I think, in Calais, which is
1815, apparently.
Yeah, 1815. Calais is the place, you know, like Beau Brummel, where ruined Regency celebrities go to die, and it's terrible, and people do feel guilty about it. And actually, I mean, you talked about kind of Victorian morality, but I think it's in the 1840s people feel so guilty about how she'd been treated that the government ends up settling money on Horatia's three children.
Oh, I see.
As a way of kind of making amends. So I think that Emma is a kind of, in a way, she's kind of the paradigm of the kind of mistress that we're going to be looking at from now on. But she's at number seven because she doesn't really, you know, she has this wonderful kind of relationship with Nelson, but she doesn't bed it down, and in a sense, the way that she's used her beauty and her notoriety to leverage herself up into a position of power and wealth, it ends up chewing her up. And of course, that's something that you know we see today with the way that celebrities get treated.
Yeah,
But our next one is also someone who came from nowhere, got involved with the theatre, but was incredibly successful.
So basically, Nell Gwynn, I mean, is very successful because in many ways she causes the least problems for her lover, in that sense, Charles II, obviously. Charles II, famous for numerous mistresses, it has to be said, one of which is Lady Castlemaine, who's
Barbara Villiers.
Particularly difficult, it might be said. Certainly to Charles.
So, and had amazing underwear.
Amazing
the Pepys,
underwear
going through Whitehall, sees Lady Castlemaine's underwear. Oof. And kind of he rushes back home, and then there's some asterisks in his diary.
But the interesting thing with Nell Gwynn, I suppose, is, first of all, where she comes from. So she's she's a, you know, an actress come fruit seller, whatever.
Well, I think even lower than that. I mean, she comes from a slum. I mean, there are kind of various stories about where Gwynn, that perhaps she comes from Wales, but I think almost certainly she's born kind of in, you know, the stews of Drury Lane, Covent Garden, and clearly there's the kind of, you know, the very, very strong whiff of prostitution around everything to do with her origins,
she's
her upbringing. Yeah, and so
in the pre-modern sense,
so she becomes an orange girl. That's the famous thing that everyone knows about Nell Gwynn, is that she sells oranges, and she's what, kind of, I think, 14.
But it seems to sort of Charles II's credit in some ways that he's besotted or falls in love with someone who is, you know, so much salt of the earth type sort of. I mean, it's not aristocratic, and I mean, there's no basis of, you know, here she is, you know, coming from basic. So in some ways, it adds to its popularity, of course, doesn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
In some ways,
yes. So she goes from being an orange girl, which basically means, you know, it's kind of the equivalent of kind of selling fruit pastels in the West End now.
Yeah.
But you're going around with your tray.
Are
of,
there people
of,
selling fruit pastels? In
it's a mystery of 17th century historiography. You know, not just oranges, kind of lemons and, you know, fruit. And
but these are exotic fruit.
Exotic, yes, exactly. And then she's very, well, she, again, Pepys calls her pretty, witty Nell. She's pretty, she's witty, and it's evident to the guys who've basically employed her in the theatre that she's got the makings of a great comic actress. And I think, I mean, I was kind of thinking who a modern equivalent would be, and I would guess it would be Barbara Windsor. She's smart, she's clever, she's funny, she's sexy, she's salt of the earth. Yeah. People just kind of seem to love her.
She's sort of like, I mean, the impression you get is that she's, for Charles anyway, she's sort of problem free. I mean, she doesn't demand anything of him.
Yeah,
well, way that others do. So they're all demanding things. She doesn't. And at the end of the day, he does actually get, you know, he does, you know, in his will, say, you know, look after Nell and all this sort of thing.
Absolutely. Well, so she comes in 1668 as Lady Castlemaine. Barbara Villiers is kind of starting to fade.
Right.
She overplayed her hand and she's aging, which of course is an occupational hazard for a mistress. Mm-hmm. It becomes known that Charles II is looking for a replacement. Mm-hmm. So there are kind of various actresses. And supposedly, Nell Gwynne gives a rival actress a laxative.
Oh, really? Oh,
just before a date with Charles II, which kind of obviously is... Well, it's...
That does...
It's a brilliant thing to do, to get rid of a potential love rival.
And then
it all goes tremendously well. But I mean, Charles II, I mean, I think that of all the... Because, of course, you know, where there's a mistress, there's a guy who has a mistress. I think Charles II has the greatest array of mistresses of any English king. And Nell Gwynne's great rival is Louise de Kerouac, who is French. Catholic. And who Nell Gwynne nicknames Squinterbella.
Squinterbella. Oh,
so again, dear. That's very kind of Barbara Windsor.
Oh dear.
You know, get out of my pub. There's a whole, you stuck up French Catholic. And there is a thing Nell Gwynne, as a kind of salt of the earth, lovable Cockney Protestant, is much more popular with the London crowds than the stuck up French Catholic.
Yeah.
There's this famous story that Nell Gwynne is out in the carriage.
The mob thinks. And she says that, you know, I'm the king's Protestant.
I'm the Protestant whore.
So they all go, great, no problem. Because we forget, of course, the sectarian anxieties of the 17th century, I should say.
Yes,
having a Catholic mistress.
And Charles himself is kind of, you know, he
he's leaning towards.
Charles II is leaning towards Catholicism, and also is basically in the pocket of the French, Louis XIV.
Yeah, absolutely, Louis
XIV. So Louise is you know his.
Is,
you know, aspirational mistress.
Was she not placed there by Louis XIV?
Yes.
Yes.
And then also you've got Frances Stuart, who famously doesn't become his mistress, and therefore, you know, plays hard to get, and so Charles is even more obsessed with her, and she's the one who becomes the first model for Britannia. So Nell Gwynne, up to this point, you could say, I mean, what's the difference with Emma Hamilton? The difference is, of course, that Nell Gwynne doesn't, you know, everything goes fine.
Yeah, because she doesn't get... Charles II dies and she is looked after, and she does her son become...
Yeah, so she has two sons.
Two sons.
And the son... The kind of various stories about how this works. One is that Charles is kind of, you know, hanging out with Nell, and the young boy, who's also called Charles, wanders in, and Nell Gwynne says, come here, you little bastard. And Charles II says, you can't call my son a little bastard. And Nell Gwynne says, yes, but that's what he is. Unless you give him a peerage.
Nicely done.
And the other story, is even more improbable, is that Nicely she done. Kind of dropped him, hung him out of a window and threatened to drop him unless Charles gave him a peerage. Which again, so he becomes, I think, the Earl of Burford and then the Duke of St. Albans. Charles
Duke.
Beauclerc.
Oh.
And the Beauclercs, I think they, the house in Windsor that they got given, they lived there until quite recently. So, and they're all kinds of members of the aristocracy to this day who
oh, the line isn't extinct then, it's still...
No, they're all very, oh, very right. proud to be descended from Nell Gwynne and you know, from Charles. So, so I think that's, you know, she's a winner.
No, I think she is. I mean, if you compare, obviously, with Emma Hamilton, I mean, that's, she's done well.
Yes, she does. She has done well. So she's in at six, and then at number five.
Yeah, this is your one, I think.
Yes. So, Lily Langtree is a fascinating, you know, she complements and contrasts with Nell Gwynn. So Nell Gwynn uses the stage to become the mistress of a member of the royal, you know, to become a king. Lily Langtree uses her affair with the Prince of Wales, the future Edward VII, to become an actress. And the reason we put her in at five is that Lily Langtree serves as a kind of prototype for possibly the two most famous mistresses of the 20th century, Marilyn and Camilla. And Lily Langtree is part of a kind of a trend in the 19th century for kind of celebrity courtesans who sleep with incredibly a range of famous people. So there's Lola Montez, who despite her name is actually Irish.
She's Irish.
Yeah, and she kind of pretends to be a Spanish dancer. And she gets off with...
She's a fascinating figure, though, I think. I mean, Lola Montez, to be honest, I would have had her instead of Lily Langtree, but...
Yes,
know,
we have debated this, Ali.
We have debated,
and
yeah.
Now is not the time.
But
Lily Montez, as you correctly pointed out, you know, she has affairs with Franz Liszt, with Alexandre Dumas, who writes The Three Musketeers, and famously with Ludwig I of Bavaria.
Yeah, that's the best.
And Lily Montez thinks she's absolutely made it. You know, she's in this hanging out in Bavaria, and then 1848 turns up, the year of revolutions, and she gets, you know, she gets to go to America. One other famous person she has an affair with, of course, is Flashman.
That's right, and that's how I became acquainted with Lola Montez, I have to say, is Flashman.
So there's Lola Montez, and then there's those of you who've listened to the episode that we did on statues may remember we are on Whitehall, there's a statue of Spencer Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire. This guy I'd never heard of till Dominic told me who he was. I mean, the most extraordinary lingerie you've ever seen on the statue. And Dominic revealed that he was most interesting because he had an affair with this woman, Catherine Walters, who was known as Skittles. And Skittles was famous for riding in the tightest riding habit that
what,
any
Hyde
woman...
Park?
Yes, riding through Hyde Park and St. James's Park in this incredibly tight riding habit. So she had an affair with the Duke of Devonshire, but also with Napoleon III and with the Prince of Wales, the future Edward VII, who probably comes second to Charles II as a royal sponsor of mistresses.
But didn't he sort of... wasn't he also quite... I mean, Edward the Seventh, I mean, in terms of l'entente cordiale, wasn't it sort of partly he was having... You know, a few of his flings were quite good for building relationships.
Well, that's what
France.
He said.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, it was important for him. Yeah.
That's
I mean,
what he told Mummy.
He was doing a diplomatic service, yeah.
I'm not sure about that.
It's important for, you know, l'entente cordiale that I have a
but,
few...
But, I mean, I think Lily Langtree is Edward VII's most famous mistress.
Famous, yeah.
You know, they had the fling long before he succeeded to Queen succeeded his mother, Queen Victoria. Lily Langtree, she came from Jersey. She was known as the Jersey Lily. Her husband, who gives her the name, I think it's Edward Langtree, he turns up in Jersey with a fabulous yacht. And so Lily Langtree, who's the daughter of this clergyman, who's an absolute ladies' man, completely notorious, kind of falls into his arms with great gratitude, and they sail off to London.
What, her father is a lady? Is that what you said?
Yeah, her father is this... I think he's the dean of
And
Jersey.
He's a great ladies' man.
He's a great ladies' man, yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. And when she's in London, she's incredibly beautiful. She gets taken up by kind of artists. She serves as a model for all kinds of painters. And that's how she ends up with the Prince of Wales. And she's with the Prince of Wales for 3 years, gets presented to Queen Victoria, unbelievably. I mean, it's kind of, you know, she's
what,
very...
What did she make of it?
Well, Lily Langtree's incredibly charming, and all mistresses. To be a mistress, it's not just enough to be gorgeous. You've got to be charming and witty and intelligent.
Yeah,
so, and so they separate. Basically, you know, Prince of Wales moves on to pastures new, but is always very fond of Lily.
Yeah.
But the problem that Lily faces once the Prince of Wales has kind of moved on is that all her creditors immediately move in because they've been living beyond their means. And so Lily's stuck for things to do. And so her great friend Oscar Wilde says, well, have you thought of going on the stage? So it exactly reverses what happens with Nell Gwynn. And she's a great success at this. She becomes she's fabulously good. And she goes to America. She's a great smash on the American stage. She starts to kind of take an interest in horse racing. Starts to own horses. Wins. She wins Goodwood. She hangs out with Gladstone. I mean, obviously, he doesn't have an affair with Gladstone. They want to have an affair with Gladstone, but she becomes incredibly famous, and she ends up marrying this guy. And I'm going to have to read this because his name is so posh, Hugo Gerald de Bath. Hugo Gerald de Bath.
Bath.
Mm. And she ends up as Lady de Bath. And in her 70s, she lives in Monte Carlo.
Oh.
Gerald is in Venice, and it's all...
So when did she die?
1920s sometime.
Oh, right. Okay.
So she's a kind of... She's a bridge between the age of the classic Victorian courtesan and, of course, the famous mistresses of the 20th century. So Marilyn, who's an actress, who is, just as famous as JFK.
Yeah.
And Camilla, who I think is actually descended from Lily Langtry.
Yes, I think she is.
So Lily Langtry, I think, is a deserved. She deserves to be at number five. She makes a tremendous success of it. Is still kind of she still has pubs named after her to this day. Oh, and I forgot to say about Nell Gwynn that Nell Gwynn, I think, is the only mistress to have a statue. We're very interested in statues. There's a statue of Nell Gwynn. She's the only. What? Royal mistress to have had a statue. There's a block of flats in Chelsea called Nell Gwynn House.
And there's a statue of her?
There's a statue of her, yeah.
Wow.
And I think, we, in our statues episode, we were...
Oh, yes, I've been past that.
We were talking about how all the, all the statues are kind of basically of generals. But we could do with more statues of royal mistresses.
Yeah.
So a statue of Nell Gwynn, statue of Lily Langtry, it'd be great. Number four.
Now this is a proper mistress.
Yeah, we're talking proper.
Yeah, this is proper stuff. None of this sort of actresses. So, Madame de Pompadour, who is the mistress to Louis XV of France. Now, the interesting thing about Madame de Pompadour is powerful as she becomes, and she actually does break some of the standards that we've been talking about. In as much as that, in the French system, in the French royal system, there was a post of chief royal mistress.
Yes.
And not only does she, fill this post, but it comes with lodgings, which is rather interesting.
Maitresse
en titre. Yeah. So, this is a formal position for Louis XV. And she ends up basically effectively running parts of the state, which is, she has quite
she
a lot of political
power. She becomes
prime minister,
power.
Basically. Yeah, she
basically
becomes. She also is there, as we were saying, long after, you said, age is a sort of an occupational hazard, but not in her case. I mean, she hangs in there.
Yes.
Until quite late, and she's she knows that she gets to a stage where she sort of says, I'm not really interested in all this intimate stuff anymore, I can't handle it. So I'm going to bring in some other people to sort out the king on this basis, as long as they don't mess around with his
So affections. It's kind of layers of mistress.
Yeah. So she's in a different league, actually, I think.
But kind of creepy and weird
as
well.
She's sort of like a second wife. But it's interesting because, when we go back, if we can go back to number 10, what's the distinction between, this as a mistress and a second wife?
Well, I'll tell you one distinction.
She's basically his second wife, right?
One distinction is that she is groomed for that position.
Groomed?
She's groomed. And I use the word advisedly.
Mm.
So she... So before she becomes Madame de Pompadour, she's her name is Poisson, so she's called Fish.
Fish?
Yes.
It's almost as bad as Paris.
Jean-Antoinette Poisson.
Yeah.
And at the age of 9, apparently, she's told by a fortune teller that she's going to win the heart of a king. And so from that point on, she becomes known to her family as Renette, little queen. And basically, her parents start grooming her to become the royal mistress, which, even for the French...
That's pretty... Yeah, I must admit,
that's quite odd, isn't
that
it?
That is a bit, yeah, that's... But...
So, rather like Emma Hamilton kind of educates herself to be able to kind of hang out with rich people, she is, she's kind of educated, given dancing lessons, all that kind of stuff. And
well, I mean, you're saying it's sort of quite creepy in some ways. It's pretty creepy to us, but probably not to well, 18th century French society. Well, I mean, if you think that, you know, their idea is that this is a formal position.
Yes. Yeah, so you're basically, yeah, so she's applying. Yeah.
Yeah, she's applying for a job.
So the king is out hunting, and she goes along to the hunting, and she wears a pink dress and drives a kind of blue chariot, and then she puts on a blue dress and drives a pink chariot while he's hunting.
Right.
And you'd think, rather than infuriating him, which frankly, if I was hunting and this woman
absolutely.
Turns up kind of scaring all the game, I'd be pretty cross. But no, he really likes this. And so then they have a masked ball at which he, very peculiarly, goes as a tree.
Goes as a tree?
He goes as a tree.
Wow.
And she goes as Diana, the goddess of hunting. So, all right. And so then they take off their masks. But you're beautiful. And there it is. She's kind of but she, as you say, is absolutely qualified to, you know, I mean, she's an incredibly impressive woman, very, very competent, and basically the king can't function without her.
Well,
and when I say function, I mean politically.
And here's the interesting thing, I suppose, in terms of, you know, where we're heading, is that she has a very, very emphatic and decisive political role to play, because she's the one who basically in the Seven Years' War manages the switch in alliance between and makes you know, Austria and France basically allied after years and years of animosity.
But the Seven Years' War, as those of you who've listened to the episode
to,
we did with Dan Snow, I mean, it actually didn't go very well.
No, not for the French.
So the famous phrase, après moi, le déluge.
Yeah, that's hers, yes.
That's a, yeah,
well,
that's her famous phrase. She was obviously awesomely competent, efficient. Also, great patron of the Enlightenment, philosophe, great enthusiast for Diderot.
But she sort of set up this house for his sort of sub mistresses.
Yes.
And called it the Stag House or something.
Yeah,
which is quite an extraordinary.
It's all very French. It's very French.
And extremely powerful, though, I think.
Yes. So I think she's in it for. But we've now come to the top three.
Okay. Here's the top. It's getting important now.
The top three. In at number three, we have a Greek. Aspasia.
I'll have to leave this one to you, Tom.
And well, no, Ali, because
well, I will
there is going to be a Persian dimension
there will
to
be,
this.
Yes, but
I there's a case, I think, for having Aspasia in at number one. So she is from Miletus, which is a famous trading city on the Aegean coast. Of what is now Turkey, had been destroyed by the Persians, Buhis, but by the mid-5th century when Aspasia is born,
sure
is starting to recover. It's likely that she is descended from a very aristocratic Athenian family to which the great Athenian statesman Pericles, who commissions the Parthenon and rebuilds Athens in its golden age. And so she goes with her sister to Athens and settles there. Now, Athens is a kind of very chauvinist place, so she's seen as a foreigner. And Athens is also an unbelievably kind of Taliban-esque place in its attitudes towards
Athens.
Women.
Oh.
Yes, so it's women are very, very subordinate in Athenian life. They do not have a public role to play at all. The women who do kind of, you know, meet men and kind of hang out with them are called hetaira. They're kind of very rather courtesans, kind of very posh, educated prostitutes. And so there is this Aspasia as this very high profile foreign woman is an obvious butt for the mockery of Pericles' enemies and for comic dramatists like Aristophanes. And so there is this kind of seam of abuse of Aspasia that she's either a high-class courtesan or a low-class courtesan, a low-class courtesan. And there are stories that she actually runs a brothel. And Aristophanes accuses Aspasia of starting the Peloponnesian War, the war between Athens and Sparta, which ends up ruining Athens, because she becomes Pericles' mistress. And the story goes that people from a city called Megara have stolen three prostitutes from Aspasia's brothel. And it's in vengeance for that that Pericles introduces a trade embargo against Megara, which in turn sets up a kind of domino effect, which culminates in the Peloponnesian War. Now, is this true? That there is a very different way to look at Aspasia, and that is to say that she is a person who has an absolutely seismic influence on the two aspects of Athens that for which, you know, it's best known in its golden age. The first is politically, and the second is in the dimension of philosophy. Yeah. So Aspasia becomes the mistress of Pericles, the most powerful man in Athens. Pericles is obsessed by her. He can't marry her because of a law that he himself has introduced, which says that Athenian men can't marry foreign women. But he basically they kind of live as effectively as man and wife. He is notorious for kissing her in public. He's notorious for kissing her every day. This is noted by Plutarch centuries later as a kind of weird aberration. You know, kissing the same woman endlessly.
Wouldn't have happened in Persia. If he'd only moved across the Aegean, eh? But it's an interesting point about how badly women are treated in Athens, actually, because, I mean, of course, you know...
Yeah, it's much more liberated in Persia. I think it's really tough. But according to Plato, it's Aspasia who actually writes the famous funeral oration that Pericles gives, which is recorded in Thucydides' history, over the war dead in the first years of the Peloponnesian War. So there's this kind of... And even the kind of Aristophanic joke about Aspasia starting the Peloponnesian War, it's casting her as a political player. And the idea of a woman as a serious contributor towards Athenian political life, I mean, is staggering, absolutely staggering. But on top of that, there's the possibility that she stands as the fountainhead of the entire Western philosophical tradition. This is the thesis of a wonderful book by the Oxford classicist Armand Dangour, who wrote a book, Socrates in Love. And he argues that, basically, before Pericles, Aspasia had a relationship with Socrates. And again, from Plutarch, we're told that Socrates used to visit her all the time with his disciples, that she instructed Athenians in rhetoric. And Armand has argued that the symposium, Pericles' great kind of dialogue, in which Socrates gives his great theory of love. And Socrates says that his philosophy of love derives from a woman called Diotima. He says that everything that I have learned, I learnt long ago, when I was a young man, from this very, very clever, brilliant woman. Who is Diotima? Armand's argument is that Diotima, it means honoured by Zeus. Pericles' nickname was Zeus. You know, a bit like Macron calls himself Jupiter. Pericles was known as Zeus. And that Diotima is Aspasia. And that therefore you can make the case that, you've got Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, Aspasia. That Aspasia stands at the head of this entire tradition, you know, which is an absolutely brilliant thesis, absolutely stunning. The reason that I haven't put Aspasia in at number one is because I think it's unproven. And the counter view is that basically we know nothing about Aspasia at all.
A good Greek myth.
Yeah, well, this is a problem. If Dominic were here, he'd just be kind of going, yeah, well, you know, it's a problem of ancient history.
I'm going to channel my inner Dominic any moment now. But I'm slightly puzzled. I mean, I must have this Socrates, though. I mean, Socrates was not renowned for being a great sort of, how should we say, seducer of, you know.
Yeah, but as a young man. Mm. And he talks about this woman that he,
I think he's in love with his intellect, I presume.
Well, as a young man, I'm sure, he fights in...
Certainly,
you know,
in the Muslim tradition, Socrates is not considered to be particularly...
And is there a Persian dimension to Aspasia?
Well, there is, now that you mention it. Which might actually go to the argument that she may well have certainly existed. I don't know about the influence that you claim she held. But Cyrus the Younger, who was the satrap, the governor of of Western Anatolia. He apparently named his mistress after her as a sort of a emulation, so to speak, which is quite interesting, actually, in that sense. So he obviously thought that she was someone of significance.
So the Persian seal of approval as well.
Lydia.
So I think she deserves to be at number three. Were the evidence a little bit firmer, she'd be in at number one.
The Peloponnesian War, remind me, who benefited from the Peloponnesian War?
The Spartans.
And who were the supporters of the Spartans?
The Persians.
Thank you.
Yes, anyway, let's move on.
She must have been important because she basically facilitated the destruction of Athens, which is...
So that's why she's at three and not
exactly,
at one.
Exactly, there you are.
Okay, so number two. Just bubbling under, we have...
Marie Walewska. Now...
And this is your choice,
this
Ali.
This is my choice, yeah. Because I think she plays a very, very important role, actually, in the history of Europe, and certainly in the history of Napoleonic Europe.
So tell her who she is.
Marie Walewska was the wife of a Polish nobleman.
A very old one,
wasn't it? A very old Polish nobleman, it has to be said, who, when Napoleon goes careering across Europe and defeats the Prussians and then the Russians, and he's heading into what is now Poland, the Polish noblemen gather round and encourage Marie Walewska. They sort of say, if you want to do your duty for your country, to your country, we would encourage you to engage in, basically, to become Napoleon's mistress. And if you become Napoleon's mistress, it will further the cause of Polish independence, because then he will have a very personal interest in all this. Now, I don't know how much of that is, you know, is realistic, but certainly he became infatuated with her. He was certainly very taken by her. And she did indeed become his mistress. And then, of course, Napoleon did then set up, from the conquest, the Grand Duchy of Warsaw, which was going to be then the sort of fledgling... I mean, the anticipation was that he would recreate the Kingdom of Poland, which had been divided amongst the empires of Russia, Prussia and Austria. So she plays quite an important role in that, I think a very strong political role. She became, despite her reluctance to begin with, I think very fond of Napoleon, and actually was the one person to visit him on Elba when he was in exile in 1814, although he wasn't terribly, I don't think he was terribly responsive, I have to say. But he has the interest. The other interesting thing, I suppose, is that he does have a son by her, which convinces him then that, of course, the problem is not with him but with Josephine, and therefore the divorce with Josephine goes ahead and he then marries into the Austrian, the Habsburg royal family. But I think she's significant, really, for... I suppose this important role she plays in European history and the influence she obviously has on Napoleon. The son, Alexander, she's then looked after Napoleon goes into exile finally in St. Helena, and the descendants are still with us. So I mean it's not as if she was thrown aside. I mean when Napoleon III comes back in and then the descendants of Alexander and others are well catered for. So I mean, it's quite an influential, I think, an influential relationship in that sense.
There's a brilliant thing I just read just before coming out that when Napoleon was in Warsaw when he met her.
Yeah.
And he had invited Josephine to come to Warsaw.
But then he said no.
Well,
he said I'm busy now.
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. He what he said to Josephine was, I love you with all my heart, but the winter is terrible.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And
it'd be far too cold for you to.
Yeah, come. Yeah. So disgraceful behaviour from Napoleon.
Well,
and do you know what the Countess Potocki said about Marie?
No.
Gorgeous but thick.
Oh really?
So that's the counter view, is that perhaps she just got lucky.
She's got well.
I mean, I agree. I think that she clearly,
presumably,
you know,
she didn't get involved.
She
too
did
much
her duty because she was very
duty.
Pious. She was a very pious Catholic.
She was Catholic.
And
she was obviously reluctant. I mean, in fairness, her husband was I think twice or almost three times her age. I don't think he was over.
He was 52 years older than her, apparently.
Yeah, 52 years older. And but the idea that a delegation of Polish noblemen would come up to you and sort of say, look, you know, I really think you need
duty.
To take one for the team.
Yeah.
off you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's obviously, you know, not not entirely. I mean, I think partly she's slightly in awe of this individual. But,
I agree.
It does turn out to be one of the great love affairs.
I mean, agree.
In fairness,
so,
it does turn out to be.
So I think she's in it too because, you know, compared to Napoleon, she's obviously a very obscure person.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And she achieves great things for her country. It's a kind of heroic thing to have done.
I mean, the only thing I would, the only, you know, the caveat I'd have, I suppose, with her and why she's probably not number one is that, you know, would Napoleon have recreated the Grand Duchy of Warsaw or helped without her? Probably yes. I mean, I think that would, I mean, this probably just edged things along.
Yes, okay. Yeah, yeah. So number one is someone who indisputably has a seismic impact on the course of history, and who perhaps more than anyone else in the list comes from nowhere. So she comes from nowhere to shape the destiny, not just of nations, but of continents. And
our number one is
La Malinche. And La Malinche, for those who don't know, she's born on the edge of the Aztec Empire.
Yeah.
Just before the Spanish arrive. So the measure of the obscurity from which she comes is we don't know her original name. We know that she was the daughter of a nobleman, probably of her mother was a slave. This is a community that is kind of constantly overshadowed by the expansionism of the Aztecs. And when she's still quite a young girl, so maybe 7 or 8, she gets sold into slavery. Perhaps her parents are forced to do it. Perhaps she gets kind of, you know, given as a way of trying to buy off Aztec aggression. So she gets taken to a great kind of slave mart. She gets bought by the mayor, a people of the mayor, Tabasco, and the River Tabasco, right. As in the Mexican.
Was she actually Aztec herself?
No, she's not.
She's from
and
one
that's
of these
no, she's not.
That are
no, so she's
subjugated by.
Yes, the so she's kind of on the absolutely, and this is really important to what then happens. So she gets brought up as a slave there. Again, we don't know what name she has as a slave, but she speaks Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs and of that kind of band. She goes. She learns Maya, and then the Spanish arrive, and. They basically the people who own her are so intimidated that they make an offering of 20 slaves to the Spanish, and this girl is one of them, and this is the making of her, because present in the Spanish ranks is a Spaniard called Jerónimo de Aguilar, who had been a slave himself. He'd been captured by the mayor, so he speaks one of the Mayan languages. And so this means that the Spanish can start to communicate, because this girl speaks Maya, the Spaniard speaks Maya, and so the Spaniards can start to communicate.
So does she learn Spanish of him?
Well, we'll come to that. So she gets given the name, she gets converted, you know, baptized, gets given the name Marina. The people of Central America, they transliterate this as Melina. They start to call her Melin-Sin, which is a kind of a way of dignifying her name. And in due course, the Spanish again kind of Hispanicizes and call her La Malincha. And the key turning moment in her life is when the Spaniards, with Hernán Cortés, the leader, go back up towards where they're going to launch the expedition against the Aztecs, go to Tenochtitlan, the great capital, attack Moctezuma.
I'm impressed you said that.
Thank you. Well, we did a wonderful episode with Camilla Townsend on this, so I had to practice for that. Yeah. And there it turns out that Aguilar does not speak Nahuatl.
Right.
And Cortés is furious about this because they can't communicate. And then La Malinche steps forward and says, I can speak Nahuatl. So you have this kind of chain that as the Spaniards march towards Tenochtitlan, La Malinche will translate from Nahuatl, will translate it into Maya. Aguilar will then translate it into Spanish. But as they go, La Malinche is very, very smart. Mm-hmm. She starts to learn Spanish. So Aguilar gets cut out.
Oh dear.
And Malinche essentially becomes the interface for Cortes and everybody in the Aztec Empire. Now, some of these, of course, are the enemies, the Aztecs themselves. But for La Malinche, this is a chance to get back at the Aztecs. And so it's La Malinche who basically constructs the alliance that enables the Spanish to defeat the Aztec Empire, because there are all kinds of subject peoples who are desperate to revolt. And it's La Malinche who is not only a brilliant linguist, but a brilliant diplomat, who essentially stitches this alliance together.
Because, I mean, the number of Spaniards, we're talking about, what, 500?
Yeah, they're very few. So La Malinche is recognised by the Spaniards themselves as having played an absolutely key role. Mm. So she has this relationship with Cortés. He has a son by him, Martin Cortés, who, for Mexicans to this day, serves as the kind of fountainhead of the mixing of the European and the Central American. So he's kind of seen as the first Mexican, if you like, in that kind of, you know, the first embodiment of modern Mexico. And she is seen by Mexicans today in a very ambivalent light. So is she a traitor?
But this is...
So for lots of Mexicans, she's seen as the embodiment of a traitor. But for lots of Mexicans, she's seen as someone who basically creates Mexico. And she has this huge, huge influence on Cortés, on the Spanish, and on the Aztecs, and on all the other various Nahuatl-speaking
peoples. You can only really see her as a traitor if you look at her through the prism of modern nationalism, surely.
I mean, absolutely.
That's the thing.
Yes.
I mean, and you can see it, but from the perspective of 16th century, you know, Mexico and whatever, she was probably, you know, taking revenge for the way her people had been treated
yes.
for many, many years.
And it's really striking that she, for instance, she never adopts European dress.
That's interesting. She
always wears...
She's recounted in Diaz's Conquest of New Spain, is that that's
absolutely.
Right?
Who and he says that... you know, that she's a hugely admirable figure. Cortés himself says that, you know, he owes, obviously, for the conquest
enormous.
Of Mexico, he owes most to God, but then he owes most to La Malinche.
I mean, it's seismic when you think about it. I mean, the role she plays in the conquest of New Spain and basically the establishment of the Spanish Empire in America is well...
Yeah,
I don't think you can beat that, really.
No, and she establishes a school of translators.
Wow.
So she's the person basically who enables, you know, the two sides to communicate. She is she's kind of cheerful. She's charming. Basically everybody loves her. I mean, everybody
so
who meets her loves
Cortés,
her.
Cortés had a wife in Spain, didn't he?
Yes, and so he can't.
Well,
he can't.
That's a long way away.
No, he's not going to marry her, but he does marry her to a kind of very well-bred conquistador, which then means that she is recognised as a donna, a lady by the Spaniards. So Cortés kind of does right by her, and she dies very young, but you know, having achieved incredible, incredible things. And I think that she's number one. I mean, we all agreed that she should be number one because. You know, as you say, she comes from nowhere. She's a slave. She's a nameless slave. We don't know what her name was as a slave or before she became enslaved. And she rises to have this outsized impact on the history of Mexico, on the history of Spain, on the history of the world. So I think that La Malinche shows just how far
we started with a slave who did basically nothing.
Yes.
And we've ended with a slave who enabled the conquest of the Aztec Empire, which is, I agree. I mean, I think her influence is outsized, really. I mean, it's enormous.
Yes. It's wonderful that you've all schlepped out here on a Friday night to hear us. So thanks ever so much. Really appreciate it.